business. It's really about infrastructure for many businesses. It's about job creation and retention of jobs in Minnesota. And it's also about access to the global markets, and you're going to hear more about that today. And then also creating a competitive business climate, probably especially for the high-tech industry in Minnesota. A little bit further in terms of how we got here, we've had a lot of support from both political parties and diverse interests. The Metro Chamber, the Twin City Cargo Association, U.S. Customs, the Transportation Security Administration, and frankly a number of businesses who have looked at how to improve their logistics capabilities in terms of accessing global markets, some of which have in fact moved from Minnesota or moved their logistics distribution and distribution centers elsewhere to take advantage of access. I'll talk in a minute or two about the tweaking of the legislation that was passed this year, last year, and what we need to do with that. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the progress that we've made since the 2005 legislation passed this past year. We have created site selection criteria. They were developed, as you may remember, we have to be within 60 miles of MSP or 90 minutes. There are some highway access issues, some local support for the incentives, and land availability issues. The RFP was issued to obtain applications from interested local governments. We now have that in hand, and we have three applications. One from Pine County, representing the Hinckley area. One from Mankato, and then also the third one is from the city of Rosemont. Those proposals are all under review right now by MnDOT and the Met Council, and then a group representing the Air Cargo Association or the Foreign Trade Zone Commission, which is called Act Fast. And someone's going to ask me what Act Fast stands for, and it stands for Air Cargo Task Force Advocating Strategic Trade. Act Fast. Representative Anderson, Air Cargo Task Force Advocating Strategic Trade. I never remember it either. So. But we will actually probably be in a position to finalize those recommendations in the next 2 weeks. I understand the Met Council has finished their application, and we should see a letter on that in the next, in the next few days. In addition, we have outlined a business plan outline and developed that, and we are in and have a consultant selection criteria defined. We actually have received two proposals to do the business plan. One is the international industry expert that you're in fact going to hear from today, who will be recommended to the Foreign Trade Zone Commission to receive the contract. We also are looking at financial modeling and financial consultants. We have two proposals in hand, and there's likely to be a third one in that regard. And we've had discussions with those groups, and we expect that that, too, will be finalized relatively soon. And all of those recommendations will go to the Foreign Trade Zone Commission, and we would expect the selection of all of that to occur yet in the month of February.
Mr. Anderson?
Yes, sir.
A brief question, if I may. The funding for the Trade Zone Commission and its activities so far, where is that coming from, or how did we appropriate money for that?
Mr. Chairman, the all of the money that's been expended so far has been Foreign Trade Zone Commission money, but the consulting contracts will in fact be paid for from a portion of the money the legislature set aside this last session for advancement of this project and to provide some incentives. That dollar amount was $750,000 in the legislation. We have, the Foreign Trade Zone Commission has asked the Department of, I always want to say it the other way, DEED, to allocate $250,000 of that for consulting contracts. We have talked to the two authors of the legislation, Senator Rest and Representative Abrams, and the governor's office. Everybody is comfortable with that. So $250,000 will be set aside of that $750,000 to do the business plan and the financial plan development.
Good. Thank you.
With regard to the business community, it continues to show interest. Tomorrow we're having a breakfast where Mr. Muscatello, who you'll hear from in a few minutes, is going to speak, and I think the attendance at that meeting is now over 50 as of this morning, and so there remains really some high interest in that. The key to all of this going forward is, in fact, the development of the business plan and the site selection. And the business plan will really determine whether we go or don't go on this project. So it becomes a key element in where we need to go. What still needs to be done? Obviously, we need to complete the business plan. That will be started in the month of February, and it would anticipate that we would be completed with that into midsummer timeline. And then we will use the business plan to establish the business case with the freight forwarder community and the shipping community. I think it's fair to say that not everybody in that industry is prepared for change and is on board with what we would like to see done here. And then we need to complete the site selection, and we would hope that we would be in a process to do that as well in the February timeframe. In terms of what we need from the legislature, first, I think the extension of the statutory deadlines. We did not have statutory deadlines in the original bill. And the June 30th deadline of 06 for the business plan really creates an artificial barrier for us. And it probably limits us in terms of getting some broad input on issues that will be identified in the business plan and dealing with that. So I think we would ask the legislature probably to push that out about a year.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Anderson, you answered my question before I got a chance to ask it. How much more time would you think would be necessary, and would it include any additional expenditure of funds beyond the $250,000?
Madam Chair, extending the timeline, I don't think will require us to expend any additional money. It won't delay what we're doing. The only thing of having that target out there is that it may limit us in terms of looking at some input issues that we ought to be looking at before we finalize the business plan. So that would be probably the most significant thing. We also have some community responses to the RFP that have indicated they would like some more time on some land issues. We may have some difficulty, depending on the selection of the site, in terms of how soon we can lock up some of those land-related issues.
Mr. Anderson, Senator Rest?
Mr. Anderson, would your third point there require a legislative change, a statutory change?
Madam Chair, no. That is just one of the things that we want to build into that timeline.
Representative Hornstein, did you have a question also related to this?
Yes.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your discussion of the business plan and the content of it, will the business plan get into specifics such as, you know, the number of additional flights that you would anticipate would be the result of this facility?
Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, the answer is yes. We will need to look at that, and one of the critical elements here is whether, in fact, the scope of this project will, in fact, bring cargo aircraft into MSP.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Mr. Anderson, proceed.
The other issue that we would ask for the legislature to do is probably we would like to delay the incentive dates by 1 year. Currently, they start in January of 07. We think we'd like to push that out to January of 08 and then also ensure that we can carry over the remainder of the $750,000 so that we don't lose that across the biennial structure. And again, that's just to give us more time to work with pieces of this. Then the other thing that we would ask from the legislature, but we will not ask this until the 07 session, is that we may want to come back and ask for reconsideration of the incentive language after the business plan is completed. And one of the things that we should be aware of, the incentives that we built into this business plan were based on a 2001 study and a 2002 economic model. And one of the things that I think you'll find in Mr. Muscatello's presentation is that the competitive environment out here is changing, and it's changing dramatically. And it's going to be far different than it was in 2002 or 2003, and which is the basis for our current incentives. So we really want to look at that. And I would not necessarily read that as a need to increase incentives. It could, in fact, go the other way as well. We just don't know at this point in time.
We talked about the landscape changing. Are you speaking about trade, taxation issues, competitive situations vis-a-vis other states, or what's...
Mr. Chairman, all three of those.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That really completes my presentation, and I know that Mr. Havis is scheduled to speak here, and then we will come back with Mr. Muscatello and Mr. Corner, and then I think we would be prepared to stand for questions across the broad spectrum of what we're looking at doing here.
But Mr. Anderson, do you think it would be helpful to, as we're educating legislators and policymakers around this table, to have Mr. Muscatello speak next before we have Mr. Hav, or would it be most beneficial for just a broad understanding of the industry and what we're trying to do to go in the order that's in the agenda?
Mr. Chairman, clearly your call. I don't know that it makes significant difference. We talked about it a little bit earlier with my people, and they were very comfortable with Mr. Hab going at this time.
All right, we'll proceed with what's in the agenda then. Good. Okay.
Thank you, and I'll be back for further questions
when
we get through.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe just to refresh my memory, I'd like to ask Mr. Anderson, when you refer to we, now this whole facility, is this going to be state-funded? Is it private-funded? Or who is this we refer to?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Leader, I apologize for that. I've been around this so much, it's the royal we, I suppose. Part of the we is really the Foreign Trade Zone Commission, which are the public entities which will have oversight. Our anticipation of this project, for the most part, it will be privately funded, and that is our intention to do that. And when I say for the most part, there is a likelihood that we would pursue some federal funding with regard to the security aspect of this program, where the Transportation Security Administration may join us in some request in that regard. We haven't gotten far enough down the road on that, except for some very preliminary discussion. But that would be the only place that we anticipate at this juncture public money coming into play other than the $750,000 that was allocated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Senator Rest.
Well, but public money is in the tax incentives.
Clearly, and the tax incentives, yes.
And Mr. Anderson, just to be clear, the Point Trade Zone Commission is a subset of DEED or DTED, or how does it function in the world of governmental agencies? Where does it fit into the picture?
Mr. Chairman, the Foreign Trade Zone Commission is, I think in Minnesota law, is a joint powers organization, but it is really formed under Title 19 of the Federal Code relative to foreign trade operation. So it has a federal.
I'm looking what you guys are all thinking. I'll say that again slower so we understand exactly.
The organizational body of the units coming together is a joint powers organization under Minnesota law.
Between the joints, there's usually more than one per.
Hennepin County, Minneapolis, Bloomington, the MAC, and Rosemont.
Okay.
And
others can join if they choose to.
And others have been members. The City of St. Paul has been a member in the past. It is not currently. But, it is really open for people to join. That's the organizational structure. Their charter for their operations really comes under Title 19 of the Federal Code for Foreign Trade.
Thank you. That's much more clear. Thank you. Any other questions or clarifications? You guys need me to lead on any other dumb questions? Thank you, Mr. Anderson. If you'll stand down for a few moments, I'd like to invite Mr. Ron Hav from Freight Masters to the stand. And while Mr. Hav is coming, Kathy, if I can ask you to pass out notes from that Mr. Hav will be referring to, that would be a good thing. I don't think I kept the coffee for myself. Thanks. Mr. Hav, if you'd hold for just a moment while we get your speaking points out here. I'm sorry I didn't have those passed out already.
H-A-V-E.
It should be on your yellow agenda. We're using this one. I think the housekeeping is complete. Mr. Hav, welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself for the tape-recorded proceedings and then proceed with your testimony, we appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ronald Hav, and I'm the president of Freight Masters Incorporated, a local trucking company here in the Twin Cities. I want to open my comments today by saying I was invited by Chairman Beard to come and make a few comments. He and I had discussions at a previous date about my feelings in the regional distribution center. So I wanted to make it clear to the panel that I really don't have any particular agenda. I'm not trying to kill the regional distribution center. I just had some things that I've seen in the list of assumptions that were inconsistent with my experience.
Okay.
My experience is 31 years of having developed a trucking company from one truck to the day when we employ about 625 people in the air cargo industry. There was a number of assumptions, and I decided to try to limit my list as much as I could because I could go on for probably the next 3 hours if you wanted me to. But
we wouldn't want you to do that.
Nor would I really want to do that. The very first concept that was developed when the regional distribution center was first considered as a possibility was the concept that there was no expedited service available to the Twin Cities corporations, thereby making us not globally competitive. And I kind of see something different than that. I see that Federal Express and UPS and DHL, that they would all disagree with that concept. They all provide 24-hour and 48-hour services to points all over the world. One of the reasons that it's typically said that we're not competitive is that people expect lower-cost airfare service to provide that rapid, expedited delivery. The point that I would bring to the panel's attention is we've got the five major airlines in this country in bankruptcy right now, and these are the people who have set the prices, and for us to imagine that they know what the prices should be is quite silly. People like our company have suffered $600,000 worth of losses in 2005 thanks to the bankruptcy of just Northwest Airlines alone, and we went down the path of United Airlines and Delta and U.S. Air and Polar Air Cargo, and the list goes on and on. At the same time, FedEx, DHL, UPS enjoyed a 3-5% gross profit for the year, each in their own way. So for me to imagine that they're making some unreasonable profit on the service that they provide is not very likely. So my experience would tell me that's something you should strongly consider, that we're trying to create a service, in my mind, that already exists. Regular service through Chicago is an average of 7 days, according to a study that was provided by CITA and by the University of Minnesota. A fellow, Mr. Doyle, I believe it was, that conducted the study, indicated that on the average, international shipments take that long. But what he failed to tell the panel was that they take that long by choice. The people that have those kinds of goods would prefer to take advantage of lower rates, so they push for consolidation out of a town like a Chicago. Chicago gets a lot of attention from this panel's inquiries, but the truth of the matter is we haul freight to New Jersey, we haul freight to Cincinnati, we haul freight to Dallas, Atlanta, we haul freight to Seattle. Big ports where big consolidation can occur. The one thing that I wanted to point to people's attention is the fact that of all the transportation consumed in the United States, air cargo is only 2% of that transportation. So when we talk about our Minnesota corporations and their willingness to stay here or not stay here, I can't imagine that a 2% likely spend is going to make the deciding factor. That's kind of my comments about the expedited service. The next bullet point that I developed here is the idea that various competitors will cease their own operations and relocate in hopes of attracting direct service from some scheduled airline. The concept that the present air freight forwarding community is developing and doing it quite adequately, in my opinion, is the concept of forwarding international goods to points all over the globe. And each of them has to find a way to differentiate their service from everyone else. I'm worried that the concept of a regional cargo center where all the goods are going to be pushed through one facility with similar handling and kind of a one-size-fits-all program is not going to be received at all by the forwarding community. They distinguish themselves by a variety of services they offer, and many of which aren't related to air cargo. They do warehousing, they do fulfillment, they do order procurement, they do a lot of things that require them to have lots of space. Some of these forwarders that are in this consideration that do some air freight forwarding have become enormous companies in America and in the world. It's likely that by us coming up with a regional distribution center, we're going to force those companies to split their operations. I'd be concerned about that. One of the other things that occurs to me is relocations to a new site, like be it Mankato or be it Hinckley or be it Rosemont, is going to cause vacancies in Eagan and Mendota in places that are very adjacent to the airport. Now, the adjacency to the airport is also adjacency to the Twin Cities greater community, so chances are those vacancies will be filled relatively fast, and then space that's presently being occupied by the air cargo industry will be gone probably forever. The next point that I'd like to make is the creation of an RDC will attract an airline to put scheduled flights into Minneapolis. One of the things that the committee needs to consider, and certainly should be part of the business plan, is the idea that we have one of the largest all-cargo fleets in the world operated right here in the Twin Cities, that being Northwest Airlines. Now, Northwest Airlines has a tremendous investment in this community. They've got facilities. They've got about 200,000 square feet of cargo space on Minneapolis International Airport. They've got personnel. They've got investment. And they've got all the things that it would take to provide this service. Yet they don't find it in their best interest to fly even one plane into this town. There have been times over my 31 years experience when Northwest has chosen to fly here, and every time that plane has never been properly supported, and eventually it goes back to Chicago, or it goes back to Cincinnati, or it goes back to Atlanta, or somewhere else. So one of the first things to wonder about is, where will the plane go? You know, I heard one of the representatives ask the question, will this creation of an RDC lead to additional scheduled flights in and out of the Twin Cities? Well, the concept that's been developed by most of the people that have been on this committee has been focused on the idea that we'll get a plane and we'll consolidate all the cargo from the forwarding community, and we'll ship that plane off to some place. Most of the conversation, not exclusively, but probably in the high 90%, has been focused on the export needs of the Twin Cities community. That airplane's got to get back to Minneapolis. So the import community's got to be considered equally in this thing. So the question that the committee needs to ask is this the most likely destination for a new flight also the most likely origin for a return flight? One of the things that people have an attitude about is the concept of a long flight that should go to Europe, that should go to the Far East, that should go to the Middle East, that should go to South America. As soon as you do that, it requires that airline to put more than one airplane into the mix if you're going to have daily service. So it's quite an investment for someone.
Mr. Havoc, could pause for a moment. Representative Hornstein has a question.
Related. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Havoc, on this topic, and it actually relates to the point you made earlier about, you know, Chicago is currently used. Let's say, you know, hypothetically Northwest would add a flight nonstop from the Twin Cities to Beijing, for example, since we're increasing our trade to China. How much time would be saved on that rather than going on United through O'Hare? I mean, in terms of shipping that, you know, again, I mean, these shipments probably range in size and whatnot, but, you know, how much, because I imagine that connecting, like, passengers would connect. I don't know exactly how this works,
but
how much time is really saved by doing that?
That's a good, very good question, Representative Hornstein and Mr. Chairman. At the very least, it would probably save 12 hours, okay? That's the most common answer that you'll receive. However, I'll point to the fact that Northwest Airlines, for example, has departures all day long out of Chicago, and they dispatch trucks quite regularly at 9 in the morning that are delivered at 5 in the afternoon and make the same day departure out of Chicago. They also depart trucks that leave at 10 o'clock at night that make the next day's departure, but it's not unusual for us to haul freight on their behalf, 2 and 3 loads a day, that makes same-day departures from Chicago. So in those particular cases, there's probably no savings at all.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Mr. Hamm?
Okay, thank you. One of the things that the cargo assembly area that I haven't heard yet is, does anybody know the tonnage and the service sensitivity for the area bound to be a particular destination? In other words, let's take Beijing, as Representative Hornstein pointed out. You know, has anybody said this is how much tonnage goes there and on what particular days, and is there that much freight coming back that could balance that airplane so that it could come back? I have a story that takes just a minute to tell. A good percentage of the people that are going to testify following me are going to remember this story. The Air Cargo Association decided that they wanted to get a plane coming in from somewhere to give some competition to Northwest at the end of the 1990s. So Bob Stassen at that time he was a director of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and he came up with what seemed like a reasonably good idea. He found the cut flower industry received somewhere close to 100,000 pounds of freight 3 times a week from Bolivia or from Colombia. So he came to the Twin Cities Air Cargo Association and said that if someone were willing to put up a fumigation chamber and make us a receiving area suitable to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, then we could start to handle these cut flowers direct out of Colombia. So I went to a couple meetings and listened to the thing, and I discovered that nobody was really stepping up in order to make that investment. And I know from my own experience, nothing of any significance ever happens in this world until the conversation changes from somebody should to I will. So I raised my hand and I said, all right, I'll put up the fumigation chamber. I spent about $76,000. I took a specific spot on Minneapolis International Airport. We had television stations out. We had the airport director. We had everybody there. We never handled 1 pound of flowers. Not 1 ounce. And the reason we never handled a pound of flowers was because nobody worried about how we're going to get that airplane back as far even as Miami, no less all the way to Columbia. Now, that seems like a fairly functional thing to decide, but nobody actually considered it. We were out about $75,000. The fumigation chamber lasted for about a year and a half until the MAC took the property back and turned it into the present Humphrey Terminal. just a good example of what we're talking about. So when I talk about these things, I've actually put some money out and tried to encourage things. One of the things that gives me a real case of heartburn, quite frankly, is the idea about how many jobs this RDC is bound to create. Now, I don't profess to know the first thing about how you calculate something like that, but I do want to make a comment about the range. I've seen the range of estimates from 5,000 jobs to 38,000 jobs. Now, these are numbers that have come from the St. Paul Pioneer Press and the Minneapolis Star and Tribune that have been quoted. Steve Anderson are quoting people that have estimated these numbers. My own experience, we do about half our business is air freight related and half of it's retail and manufacturing oriented business. The people that I know that have left Minnesota have left typically because of the high cost of labor and tax situations and maybe moving closer to their domestic market. I don't know if it's appropriate to name names or not, but people have moved into Indiana and Ohio and places like that because they realize that if they have a location of 400 stores in the U.S., they can reach 300 of them overnight from Ohio, where they could only reach 170 from Minneapolis. Really didn't have all that much to do with anything other than our geography and where it was located. Without trying to be smart aleck about it, our neighbors to the west haven't done much to increase their populations, which doesn't make it an awful easy sell when we're the end of the universe and the wilderness exists until you get to the coast. So Minneapolis takes a black eye, or the Twin Cities takes a black eye for that. One of the things about the creation of these new jobs, if you're going to have an RDC that's going to be competitive, you've got to have competitively priced employees. I'm really worried about the fact that of all three places that have been recommended, you don't have any semi-skilled labor force immediately adjacent, and you don't have public transit. I have my own opinions about the idea of picking up a piece of freight in Richfield and hauling it to Hinckley to haul it back to Richfield. That doesn't seem to make any sense to me, but maybe somebody sees something I don't. But be that as it may, assume for a minute that if Rosemont becomes the site, which is clearly the most practical one, then there's this issue of public transit, semi-skilled labor, and the labor needs to be very open to 24-hour availability. You've got airplanes coming and going, so just food for thought for the conference here. One of the things that I hear a lot, and quite frankly, this could be a reason to have an RDC, and that is the security issue. If the Transportation Security Administration decides they want to start to scan all the cargo, it's going to help a lot to have it in one place. I would caution the committee when you think about that, because people like UPS and FedEx are certainly not going to take 7 to 10 airplanes full of freight every night and transfer it to a location for scanning. They're going to petition you and ask to have their own scanning equipment immediately plane side, which will mean whoever the cargo operator is that comes in with his scheduled flight is going to cry foul, because he's going to say, you've added to my cost and you've delayed my service by your requirement that I go to this special place to have the scanning. Me too, I want the scanning. And then they've got the space and they've got the availability. So I worry about that. One of the things I think exists when you put all that cargo in one particular spot and you put it on the highway between the airport and the location of the RDC, I think you create a terrorist opportunity. I think that right now a terrorist would have no idea which truck is carrying what or where it's going or where it's come from or where it's going to. So therefore, there's some security in the diversity that exists in the marketplace. Today, I don't think that's true if you put the RDC together. And you could worry a lot about that particular issue. I suspect that the closer that you can get to the airplane, the better off you're going to be. I want to make a comment about developing the RDC with private investment. I think that's a very good idea, and I applaud the committee's concept. I like the concept completely. I want to point to the fact, however, that if you only pick one developer or maybe two, they're going to have to be the big boys. You're going to have the Opuses or the Duke Properties or people like that. There's an awful lot of the people in the air cargo industry that are small mom-and-pop shops like our own that have a significant portion of their own net worth tied up in real estate that they've invested in to provide service to their own business. So one of the things that I'd encourage the committee to consider is don't just focus on we want one developer to guide and control this whole thing. It gives that developer a monopoly, and it does it at the expense of people. Now, there's an added consideration. If people like me are forced to move from Eagan out to Rosemont, all of a sudden my building in Eagan probably becomes worth less because there'll be this glut of property on the marketplace, and I may have to move pretty quick in order to keep competitive with the RDC. Infrastructure investments, one of the things that you'd probably want to consider, I know there's been dramatic improvements on Highway 52 and 55 in the past few years, but it's still a real bottleneck. It probably would need, if this facility were to be built in Rosemont, it would probably need at least additional lane all the way from 494 out to the facility. So there's consideration for public monies that would probably have to be built in order to properly serve that, especially since the concept that's being developed is highly expedited, highly predictable flow of goods back and forth to the airport. You're going to need good flow. You can't be sitting in traffic missing planes. Downwind from the refinery, you know, is one of the things about this Rosemont deal, you know. In the world today, you know, people like our trucking companies get very concerned about every decision we make for negligent entrustment and things like that that are all part of the vogue in society. I'd worry a little bit. I doubt that the emissions from the refinery are toxic in any way. I doubt it very much. But at the same time, if somebody does end up with lung cancer or something, I wonder who's liable if the state has directed all the efforts to that particular location. And my last comments here are surrounding the subject of double counting statistics to make the facility seem probable. You know, one of the things that I worried about, I haven't really investigated this, I haven't researched it and studied it, so I'm not claiming that I've done a scientific study to back up my opinion, but I get the impression when somebody says there was 60,000 tons of air cargo last year from Minneapolis, it includes the cargo that was shipped by the integrators. And so if we're going to talk about the integrators, I can guarantee you that there's no chance that they're going to use this RDC. They're going to have their own, they already have their own facilities. Metropolitan Airports Commission built them some beautiful facilities and did a very nice job of it. FedEx and UPS have state-of-the-art facilities, as do other people like Kitty Hawk and DHL and ABX and all kinds of people. So those folks are not going to move off the airport. So I would just caution you that when you check the statistics to support the thing, that you're dealing only with the goods that are actually likely to end up in the RDC.
So one of the things that's... Just to clarify, when you talk about integrators, you're talking about the overnight companies like DHL and FedEx.
Right. DHL, FedEx, and UPS.
Evergreen and whatnot. Yeah.
The one of the things I know for a fact, the forwarders, when they talk about the tonnage that they handle, they do not particularly differentiate that very well. They talk about their tonnage in terms of all tonnage, and a good percentage of that never intended to go near an airplane because it was surface freight or it was delayed release or various products that they've invented. And then I don't know if this is true or not, but if any of the truckers have reported any of the tonnage figures that were used in the studies to justify this, that has a high possibility of duplicating the tonnage. In other words, a shipment is handled by Barry's company, GeoLogistics. If he reports the tonnage, and then you ask me, and I happen to handle that piece of freight, maybe I've counted that freight too. So there's a possibility for duplication. I said when I began that I really don't have any agenda to try to kill this. I just would like to make sure we go in with our eyes open and our heads up. If we're going to do this, I'd hate just like sin to have it a big investment and a big pile of land set aside and egg on our face. So I'll take any questions that anyone would like to answer.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hall, my understanding that most of the freight that doesn't go through MSP goes down to Chicago. You haven't commented about Chicago. Isn't it correct that they're assuming that O'Hare can't handle anymore and they're talking about building a new airport? Wouldn't that have some bearing on what's going on here? Especially if they're talking even passengers without freight, my understanding.
Mr. Representative Leader, I think you're exactly right. If in fact that becomes a reality, I think it's very likely that you'll see an opportunity for a city like Minneapolis to participate in that. The thing I would caution you about is right now the airlines that have previously put all this pressure on O'Hare are all in a tough position right now. They're mostly bankrupt, and even the ones that haven't officially declared bankruptcy have no money. So instead of increasing flights and instead of increasing demand on that airport right now, it's kind of leveled off and maybe in some cases actually retarded. The big integrators, the package express people, the UPSs, the FedExes, they've moved out of O'Hare. They're down in Indiana and they're down in Memphis and they're in other places, Fort Wayne, Indiana. They've established pretty big airports. ABX, for example, bought the whole airport at Wilmington, Ohio. And they just use it for their own purposes. They've moved out to places where they could come. So that there, again, is taking pressure off that industry.
Well, Mr. Habb, you've inspired questions that I have for the RDC folks here that, speaking for myself. It was one of the thought, just for the committee's edification, I know O'Hare is moving ahead with the runway expansion addition program that involves moving a cemetery and a city the size of Shakopee, I believe, is in the way of a new runway or two. So that'll be a few years out, but there is some capacity coming there. If you would be available for questions, we may want to get into the reality of why so many aggregators and so on are living in Chicago and tend to suck freight from a large area to Chicago, or perhaps our friends on the Foreign Trade Zone Board would be able to talk about that. But can you stay for a few minutes for questions?
I'd be glad to. Thank you.
Any further questions for this testifier? Thank you, Mr. Habb, for your testimony. Then we have Mr. Daniel Muscatello to come and talk to us a little further about the RDC project. Mr. Muscatello, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the audio tape, we'd appreciate it.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Daniel Muscatello. I'm a managing director and director of Air Cargo with Landrum & Brown. We're international consultants for aviation, and my specialty is air cargo. First of all, I want to thank the committee for this opportunity. I've got a lot of material here. I will try and go through it quickly, but obviously...
Are you working from this book now? Or which?
I am indeed, yes, sir.
Okay. Members, it's the one with the spiral binding on it.
Senator
Rest?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Muscatello, I would prefer that you be thorough rather than merely brief.
Please.
I will be as thorough as my afternoon is yours. Let me go through, first of all, a little bit of general background on the condition of the air cargo industry, because I think it's important to understand just really what the region and the industry itself is dealing with today. We know that the economy is relatively flat. In 2004, and I don't have current 2005 data here, so, you know, forgive me for that, but, you know, I can speak to 2005 if the committee has questions. The 2004 industry air cargo tonnage showed recovery but slid back somewhat in 2005 in many airports. The impacts of war and terrorism have altered shipping patterns throughout the world. Escalated fuel prices are cutting margins for many of the smaller businesses, and as was alluded to earlier, for many of the carriers that are in the business today, and there's reduced passenger capacity. That reduced passenger capacity is important because what it means is there's less belly cargo out there. You know, and I'll differentiate between freighter operators such as a JAL who might have a full freighter or Nippon Cargo Airlines or Cargolux. Then there are carriers like American, United, who put all their freight in the belly of passenger aircraft. And then as Mr. Happ indicated, you have integrators like FedEx and UPS and DHL. And an integrator means a carrier that takes its cargo from point to point. It integrates the air and the truck elements of the cargo operation, and that's hence the term integrator. A little bit of forecast data I think is important. The FAA, which does an annual forecast, indicated that through their forecast period of 2016, domestically air cargo should grow 3.7% and internationally 6.7%. The additional growth in the international is predicated largely upon the economic emergence of China as a major power in the world. Freighter growth, Yes, sir.
Senator Rest?
The growth is from a baseline of what? Of a dip?
No, it's from a baseline of really the 2004 numbers that they operated from.
And in 2004, we had had a decline from 2001. So we're not back at the pre-2001 numbers.
Madam Chairman, I can tell you that the industry has been in turmoil since April of 2000, when an economic recession began to cut back into the numbers experienced, particularly domestically here in the United States. That downturn was exacerbated by the events of September 11th, 2001. And there have been other incidents which have occurred which make it almost impossible to track and really determine actual patterns in air cargo over the past 4 or 5 years. So when it comes to doing forecasts, consultants such as myself and the FAA really struggle to get a good solid number, and what we're trying to do is build a baseline predicated upon the last 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
Thank you.
Freighter growth will probably lead this by 3 points at 3.7%, and belly growth will be less. And the important thing to recognize here, and it's very important, and we'll touch on that a little bit later on, is that the use of freighters to move freight in the industry will grow from 76 to 80%. This is the FAA's forecast. Now, this has important implications for physical planning on airports such as Chicago, who need to be able to accommodate those freighters when they park.
Now, Mr. Muscatella?
Yes, sir.
I have an obvious question here. If it looks like domestic freighter growth is going to be 3.7% up above, what do you mean freighter use will grow 76 to 80?
And in other words,
80 range, or is it growing from 76?
It will grow from 76 to 80%. In other words, the total cargo moved in the United States by air will shift from 76%, which is carried in freighters now, and that includes UPS, and right, to 80% of the total market. Now, some of the industry changes that we're seeing, and I alluded to earlier, there's less belly cargo capacity out there. Most of the domestic carriers that we have right now, with the exception of Northwest, which has freighters, have reduced all of their operations. If any one of us goes on an airplane today, it's a lot more crowded than it was a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because there are fewer flights, and because in many cases they downsize those aircraft to smaller aircraft. So that fills up the belly with baggage and reduces belly cargo capacity out there. This has created a greater reliance on freighters and an increased use on or reliance on trucking for domestic cargo movement. We've seen industry consolidations and failures. We have reduced yields for carriers, and this also flows through the rest of the industry, to freight forwarders, customs brokers, to trucking. All of these elements of the cargo industry have seen their profit margins suffer. We've seen enormous growth in the Asian market, and then there's this huge unknown of the new security requirements and how they're going to impact the air cargo industry. The uncertainties that we face today are the general state of the economy. In August 2001, FedEx assumed the mail contract, and what that has done is drastically distorted the reporting of cargo and the carriage of mail by domestic carriers. So this has further exacerbated reporting difficulties and tracking difficulties for future trends. FedEx refuses to report the mail that it carries as a separate category. So we really don't know now how much mail and how much cargo FedEx is carrying. And they've lobbied in Washington to try and get this corrected, and FedEx has been adamant about doing this. So it exacerbates exactly how much cargo and mail is moving out there.
Mr. Muscatella.
Yes, sir.
A spurious question that may come back later, but when was the contract to move the mail from the airlines to FedEx initiated? In 2000.
I don't know when it was initiated per se. It was executed in August of 2001.
Just before September 11th.
Yes, sir. And that's further complicated the patterns, because the industry didn't have time to react or track the impact of that transfer. And then in September 11th, everything just went downhill.
Right.
We have second and third day trucking. We've talked about the integrated carriers. Much of their product now never gets on an airplane. It moves to second and third day trucking. And we've seen domestic trucking, a huge rise in domestic trucking here in the United States. We've seen on the West Coast ocean-borne cargo dock strikes. And what that does is that pushes more air or cargo that would typically move on a vessel into an airplane. And this has distorted tracking cargo again. There are new freight constraints on passenger aircraft. and as I alluded to earlier, the unknown TSA guidelines. And I think the unknown TSA guidelines is something that's going to be critical for this region. In the past, federal guidelines have been twofold. One is facilitation, assisting the flow of cargo through the airport facilities, and the other has been interdiction, which is protecting against contraband goods and theft. Today we see an emphasis shift from anti-theft to anti-terrorism, from facilitation to interdiction, and from keeping things in the system to keeping things out of the system. Now, there have been a number of bills and discussions proposed about potential security responses on air cargo. The first, and I will go through these very briefly, but most of them are fairly traumatic for the industry. The most extreme is no cargo in the belly of passenger aircraft. If that happens, you will see not only bankruptcies, but failures of carriers who sustain many of their operations through the profit margins that they can make on air cargo. 100% of inspection of belly cargo would also cause enormous problems for carriers as well as for airports. And I'll discuss a little bit of those as we get further in. Ramping on down, they talk about partial inspection of belly cargo, and we've heard percentages anywhere from 10% up to 40, 50, 60, 75%. Sky marshals on freighters. I have an associate who said he never knew of an unruly box on a freighter. But nonetheless, this is one of the components of the bill. The imposition of a security fee, I think, is fair to cover some of the costs. The extent and who will pay for that has never been resolved. Tighter aeronautical access controls, in other words, getting out onto the ramp where the aircraft are parked, that's fair and very reasonable. Background checks is fair and reasonable, and physical screening for workers is fair and reasonable, but will impose additional costs on many of the smaller businesses and possibly cause failures and consolidations. Now, what are the potential impacts on air cargo? Although there will be a heavy focus on administrative controls in any proposed TSA program, there are physical implications for airport entry, entry into the site or the cargo complex, entry into the cargo building, and entry into the airside where the aircraft are actually parked. And what I'd like to do specifically today, because I think it has direct bearing on a regional distribution center, is talk about airport entry. And this gets us to the issue of truck inspections. Right now, trucks operate in fairly defined shipping windows when you go to international gateways. Typically, at an airport like a Chicago, Miami, LAX, or New York, at all of which we've done some work, you have fairly defined shipping windows in the afternoon so that trucks arrive in the afternoon to drop off their cargo to get on international flights going out in the evening. Well, at any of these large gateways, the number of trucks could reach 200 to 300 in a two-hour period. Now, if we allow for a TSA or a security inspection requiring this product be checked and reviewed, if we allow 2 minutes per truck, at Chicago, this could create a queue of 600 minutes or 10 hours for a truck to get inspected and into the airport facility. Now, this is an extreme example. And we suspect that the industry will be somewhat more moderate in how they impose these kinds of guidelines and restrictions. But even if you have 2 minutes per truck, and that's a pretty fantastically efficient inspection, it will begin to divert cargo out of some of these major gateways to other gateways where the inspection queues will not be as long or where physical facilities can be designed to accommodate this rate of inspection in such a way to allow the cargo to get on the flights on a timely basis. This also will have an impact on existing airport roadways and space. Major gateways are physically constrained. We mentioned Chicago. We are also working in Chicago. Chicago is going to be developing 200 additional acres on airport for air cargo. This will probably begin to take place somewhere within the next 12 to 18 months. Most of this space is already spoken for because of additional demand off airport, and these folks will move on airport. So the constraints and the trucking issues will not go away because of additional development there. I can't speak to the issue of the third airport because I just don't know enough about it right now. In airports like Chicago or Miami or L.A., and cargo is trucked from this region to all of those airports, you'll begin to see roadway congestion off airport, which will begin to have additional problems on the surrounding communities. And all of these gateways on airport truck queuing, which is important because the driver gets there and cannot immediately pull up a gate, his truck to a bay immediately. Most times a driver has to go in, get the paper processed, and then pull up to the truck bay. Most airports don't have truck queuing. And as we have a continued reliance on trucking and truck delays, the queuing problems will become exacerbated as well. So the potential implications of this are extensive delays at major gateways for international cargo, air quality deterioration because of truck queues, reduced regional cutoff times. Now, that's a term of art with which you're probably unfamiliar. Basically, folks have to get their cargo ready to get to the airport in time to make a flight. They have a cutoff time. In other words, it might be 2 o'clock to get to Chicago by X time or 3 o'clock to get to this airport by another time. So they establish cutoff times. If you have to deal with these long queues, that cutoff time is going to become much longer. So you're not going to be able to generate as much product, and the profit margins of most folks will suffer because of that. There will be potential roadway modifications, traffic flow issues, land demand for screening facilities. If, in fact, you have to screen air cargo, do you put that screening equipment in the individual cargo buildings, or do you build a separate screening facility? If the airport doesn't have the property to do it, then the only place it can go is into the individual buildings. And if you put it in individual buildings, those buildings will begin to lose 10, 15, 20% of their capacity in order to handle that cargo screening internally. The main thing that comes out of all of this is a possible shift to alternate airports, which is why a concept like a regional distribution center could make sense here. There will be additional shift to trucking, and there will probably be a regional loss of jobs as cargo is turned away from some of those other airports.
Mr. Muscatello.
Sir.
I want to go back to your alternate airport discussion point for just a minute, because as I've been listening to this discussion go on for a couple of years, I sense an expectation from communities around the state that there is a real possibility that international air freight, even domestic air freight, may leave MSP and could go to, take your pick, Owatonna, Wilmer, St. Cloud, Red Wing, where have you. Is that possibility any part of this discussion that we're talking about here? Because it doesn't seem to make sense that that would happen if the capacity is coming and going from MSP, the big airport.
Yeah, quite frankly, sir, we haven't looked at that yet. I mean, our market assessment would determine some of that and some of the issues, you know, particularly the viability of this entire concept.
Mm-hmm.
We don't come in here with a preconceived notion.
Okay.
What we really want to be able to do, though, is understand the market. Mm-hmm. My gut feeling is that an airport like Minneapolis would probably benefit more from these issues than be adversely impacted by that. It's at airports and regions that are physically and geographically constrained from expansion or accommodating some of these potential new needs, I think that we will see those adverse impacts. And airports, and I hate to use the term of secondary airports, but this is not a major gateway, but an airport such as this, or Orlando, or Denver, or Ontario and Los Angeles, will tend to profit from something like this.
Okay, thank you.
The business realities. Most of the nation's top 20 cargo airports have severe land constraints. Almost every airport has to choose between cargo and passengers, and almost invariably they choose passengers. Unlike passengers, goods can easily travel in a number of different ways and can shift. So product that might be bound for this region, which travels through Miami, can travel through Minneapolis just as well. Cargo is very, very flexible, and the industry keeps it flexible because that's the way they make their money. Potential security requirements could require substantial new modifications to property. Many of the potential changes could involve greatly increased costs. I won't get into the discussion of the TSA breakdown of how these costs are allocated, but of a proposed budget of $876 million for quote-unquote cargo security requirements in the United States over a 10-year period, what they are doing is telling us that airports will only be required to spend about $900,000 in 10 years. And that's patently absurd.
Representative Anderson has a question, please.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Muscatello, regarding your last point on the business realities, potential security requirements, are there airports now that have put in security equipment, security devices that have potentially slowed down the delivery of products and things like that? I'm thinking overseas, like going into London or Rhein Main or somewhere in Germany?
The German security is ahead of ours over here. There has not been noticeable delays in the movement of cargo by air, but we have not had time to really take a look and see what the impacts have been on the ground. And that, I think, is one of the key issues. Logan has increased their inspection rate from about 5/10% to about 30% of some of their belly cargo on select flights. And the industry has complained quite substantially about delays that they've encountered up there. The integrated carriers like FedEx, UPS, and DHL already do substantial screening right now. And their security requirements are far superior to anything else in the industry. I was recently in China, and China inspects every single piece of cargo that gets on an airplane before it gets on the airplane now. They do 100% screening, at least out of Shanghai right now, and other airports are looking at that. So it varies depending upon where you are in the world and what the level of concern, quite frankly, is with terrorism, sir.
Thank you.
Few airports are positioned to effectively address expanded property and financial requirements, and many businesses that operate on low margins cannot meet higher costs. So that's part of the problem. Regional roadway systems at gateway airports will be tested, but there will be opportunities created at other airports for cargo growth. What I'd like to do now, is, if time permitting, is take a look at a more regional perspective. I took the liberty of pulling together some statistics at Minneapolis in 2003, and you can see the cargo is highlighted in yellow. I apologize if some people have black and white copies. Passengers and operations, pretty much a straightforward number. If we take a look at statistics in 2004, you can see that the airport, except for cargo, was extremely healthy and had a pretty good year, with operations up 6.1% and passengers up 10.7%, but cargo was down 5.7%.
I take it those numbers are tonnage in cargo, right?
That is, yes, sir. If we take a look at a more regional analysis, if we take a look, and these are just cargo statistics, I took 2002, 2003, and 2004, and I used Minneapolis and Detroit and O'Hare. And you can see that of the three airports, only Minneapolis showed a downward trend in cargo for the past 2 years, or 2003 and 2004. Detroit recovered somewhat in 2004, and you can see the growth in Chicago. And that's particularly key, because they're pulling cargo from all over the region. Now, when we talk about accessing the international market, there are four C's that I'll talk about, and then the emerging global response. When we talk about the four C's, we're talking about connectivity. In other words, if you go to an airport, you want to be able to connect to truck distribution and possibly other carriers, which they refer to as interlining. So, for instance, if you have a carrier flying in from Asia, they might want to put cargo on American or United or Delta or Northwest and fly it to other domestic locations, or take it off and put it on a good, substantial trucking network. Consolidation. And this is one of the big advantages that the major gateways have now. And I think Mr. Half alluded to it earlier. They have the ability to consolidate enormous amounts of cargo there and get it onto flights at virtually any time of the day. This is an advantage that most airports do not have. And because the consolidation affords economies of scale, you're able to reduce the price of shipping out of those on those consolidated shipments, and it represents a substantial savings in dollars to people shipping cargo. Costs, capital and operating, the entire industry pivots around cost right now. The margins are so low in cargo, it costs right now the same amount to ship a ton of cargo from New York to London as it did in the 1980s, actual cash dollars. It's that cheap, and the yields are that low, and the industry has been penalized and suffered that much. So when we talk about growth, we have to understand that the growth comes, out of the bellies of the industry, really, out of the freight forwarders and also out of the shippers. So, some of this growth is a little bit misleading. And catchment, where the cargo originates and goes. We have to have a defined catchment area, and in this case, for this region, we would define a catchment area anywhere from 200 miles to 400 miles, which means within that radius, we would try and target pulling cargo into the regional distribution center or into the airport from that bigger range, which actually means probably pulling some cargo that might now be going to Chicago and pulling it in here. Now, is that a pipe dream? It may very well be. The industry will tell us as we get into this and dig into it further. Major competitors, obviously, or JFK. Believe it or not, a lot of cargo goes to JFK. South American cargo goes down to Miami. It's trucked down there. Asian cargo is trucked out to San Francisco and to Los Angeles. That's the way the industry works. They will go for the cheapest price. With second and third day delivery in many cases, trucking will allow us to take anything virtually anywhere in this country. The trucking industry has benefited somewhat from the adverse effects of security constraints, but certainly they're suffering too because their margins are down. The global response, we've seen business consolidations, physical consolidations, manufacturing shifts, and development of logistics parks and distribution centers. Within the past 3 months, my firm has been involved in discussions regarding logistics facilities in Virginia, the state of Washington, Florida, and over in China in Guangzhou, Shenzhen, and Shanghai. This is not a domestic phenomenon. It's an international phenomenon, and where airports have the space and the region to do this, this is what they are trying to proceed with. The sketch that you see up there is actually a physical model that we built for a competition to design a logistics park proximate to the airport in Chicago, or rather in Shanghai. And what I'd like to do is give you a little bit of the key elements of some of the things about this park. One, there is obviously an international emphasis there. The airport in Shanghai at Pudong is forecast to carry 6 million tons of international cargo by the year 2025. By contrast, last year, MSP handled about 300,000 tons. The park under plan is 1.1 square kilometers. It would include 2.7 million square feet of manufacturing and logistics. It would involve heavy security emphasis and direct connection to the airport. Now, if you look at this, the slide repeats itself, but if you look down at the base of the slide, you can see this, well, there's a little reflecting pond, and then there's a security compound, and 24 lanes of traffic to get into the airport for their international cargo. This is because of the stringent security requirements that they have, which requires an enormous amount of access and planning, roadway capacity, to get onto the airport. And this is a requirement that is not going to be capable of being met at most airports here in the United States. Taking ownership of air cargo, I think, is critical. As we see, based on my brief exposure, the mission of the RDC is to help the region recapture air cargo tonnage that is transported out of the region to other gateways for international shipment and to backhaul inbound cargo to local consuming entities. The potential benefits of such development increase the regional presence of manufacturing, distribution, and logistics. This is not a park that's going to specifically accommodate freight forwarders. It is too large, too huge, and hopefully too forward-thinking, just merely to focus on the freight forwarder community. If successful, it will grow the regional tax base. It will increase jobs. The number is undetermined yet, as far as I know. There is an opportunity to pre-clear international shipments. We have worked on several projects with the TSA, and they're interested about how shipments might be pre-cleared through some sort of a distribution center or a centralized facility in order to eliminate some of the stress and the problems that they have working on airports. And there is also an opportunity to capture and expand air cargo business. The key is manufacturing growth. Firms for the park would be focused on international business and large-scale distribution. That would be one of the concepts that we would anticipate. Operations would be geared towards air-eligible products that can be consolidated for outbound destinations. And consolidation, again, here is the operative phrase. Because if you can't consolidate, if the industry does not cooperate, if our market research tells us that consolidation is not feasible, then this is not a viable product for air cargo. It may still very well be an ideal opportunity for the region to consolidate manufacturing and create a large distribution center for landbound cargo. The center would accommodate ancillary and supporting services for air cargo, trucking, customs brokers, freight forwarders, etc. There are regional tax benefits potentially. New businesses generate new revenues. That's pretty much the way it goes all over the world. The logistics growth will require new supporting businesses in addition to the manufacturing. Additional income will add regional purchasing power. And the old axiom, a rising tide carries all boats. We anticipate that any such project such as this would cause increased jobs. Other than the immediate jobs generated by construction, there will be additional positions involved in operations to include IT and maintenance. Existing regional jobs will be retained. There will not be a loss of cargo jobs and cargo-related jobs outside the region. In air cargo, for planning purposes, we've noted that one of the guidelines for economic assessment is that 1,000 tons of air cargo typically generates throughout the system 20 to 30 jobs. And that's important to understand. Now, that would be 10 to 15 jobs here in this region for 1,000 tons of air cargo. If you lost 5,000 tons of air cargo last year, you lost potentially 50 to 75 jobs for the region. Air cargo growth. The center will provide for the systematic and timely consolidation of international air cargo. This will enable the region, and this is very important. Again, we heard earlier testimony that it's very difficult to get a handle on the volumes of these cargo and the destination. The design of this facility should and must, I believe, include a system to enable the region to track cargo volumes, to make a case for international air service to MSP. We do marketing on an international basis, and the first question, the first thing that we are asked for, no matter where we go, is show me the numbers. How much actual cargo moves from this region to our region, and how much cargo can you take back from our region to your region?
Mr. Mustafello.
Sir.
We have a hometown airline based here.
Yes, sir.
That does a lot of flying all over the world. Do they have anybody on their team that is actually looking at these things, that cares about this project, or that has experience here, and or are they just sitting back waiting for us to say, hey, we've got enough to have a dedicated freighter to Shanghai or something like that? I don't have a handle
yet on that, Chairman.
I'm sorry we didn't ask them to be here for this hearing today, but at some point, I'm assuming that as a business plan process moves forward, that would be one question.
They would be a major source of inquiry and information for this
project. Right, thank you.
Yes, sir. And consolidation of cargo truck to other gateways will reduce costs and time, making ground shipping from the center more attractive. International air cargo growth. We believe that how regional cargo moves will change. We've seen signs of it already. More trucking routes will be built around the center, both inbound and outbound. Trucking to and from other gateways will eventually evolve into trucking to and from the center and MSP. Using data from the center, the region can help MSP add freighters that will further help retain and grow business. The operating concept, to consolidate the cargo to make fewer trucking trips outside the region. Use efficient consolidation to reduce overall shipping costs. And this is key. If you can reduce shipping and operating costs, it makes doing business in this region a lot more viable for people who operate on low margins. Use the broadened connectivity associated with the center to attract new business and trucking activity. And track the cargo to develop data for MSP. The operating concept further. Work with MSP and the federal agencies to develop expedited clearance for goods shipped through the airport. Develop special facilities to provide value-added services to the air cargo community. This is not going to be a typical logistics park as we understand it now. It is more focused on air cargo than virtually any other development in the country. It is a development rooted in reality, unlike other air cargo concepts like the Global Transpark in North Carolina or the frequently proposed use of former military bases as cargo hubs. It will require partnerships with the business community, regional economic development entities, trucking organizations, the broker forwarder community, the airport, and federal agencies. As they say in a well-known TV show, the truth is out there. Today, however, we just don't know what it is. To the fact that the air cargo industry is changing and that regions must anticipate and plan for change in order to remain competitive in the future. Thank you for the opportunity.
I really appreciate your comments and for putting them down concisely in writing so we can get them visually as well. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Muscatello, are there any other, you mentioned Detroit, JFK, and Chicago O'Hare as the prime competitors. Are there any other Midwest or even Mid-South markets that are considering anything like this, or are we the only one?
Well, we hear talk about it all the time. The difficulty is in finding people who will make it real. A concept like this struggles because there are many pros and cons with it. You need a determined community. You need a determined legislative effort behind it. And you need dollars behind it. Once you get that concept and those things in place, then you need the reality of a market. I alluded to the fact that the Global Trans Park, they got enormous allocations from Congress, about $20 million for the development of runways. And that's been executed, it's been developed, and they're not moving any cargo at all through that. I frequently get calls from folks affected by the base closings about the viability of developing a cargo park or a cargo effort there. And in reality, it's very difficult to do. What makes this region so unique is you already have a pre-existing market. You know, the idea is not to build one, but to keep it from eroding and to grow it. And that's a totally different business dynamic and effort. You have the opportunity, you have, I think, three or four potential sites for a park like this, all of which, you know, offer different kinds of advantages. And certainly, you have the ability, I think, to bring something like this in proximate to the airport within a reasonable drive time, which many other regions do not have. Plus, you are located centrally within the country, despite, you know, allusions to being out on that perimeter. But you still are very well situated to draw from a reasonable catchment basin and bring in a fair amount of cargo. There are no such projects that I know of in Indiana. I heard mention of the potential third airport in Illinois. I have no idea where that is or how far away that is.
Mr. Muscatel, that would be Piatone, and that's mostly a business and general aviation
airport. Yeah, we were asked at one point in time to look at Piatone, but, you know, there's, you know, people will be very hard-pressed to go away from where they can consolidate cargo, like Chicago, to another area, unless there already is, you know, tremendous synergy with the trucking industry and the aviation industry, which you have here. So even though there might be mention of it, the fact is it would be very difficult for something like that to be competitive unless it were at another regional or major airport. Thank
Senator Rest, Representative Horton?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Muscatello. I wonder if you would just recap what your job is going to be now as we move forward with this and the work that you're are doing for the foreign trade zone.
I can do it pretty simply and concisely. We've been asked to take a look at the industry here and see if this concept could work.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Members, Senator Rest has a commitment at 4, and I think some of us might also. So we're going to try to get through the major testimony here by 4. We have two other people on the docket. So if we can speak concisely and quickly, that would be a good thing. Mr. Muscatel, if you could stand by for questions later if they come up, we'll excuse you and we'll ask Mr. Barry Corner to come up. And Barry, while you're coming, could I have Ron have, because I got just two quick questions for Ron that may help the committee in their thinking too. Would you come back to the microphone, please, Mr. Happ? And don't bring your long-winded answers because these are going to be concise.
I specialize in quick.
Okay. Mr. Corner, don't go far. Mr. Abbott, you've got a trucking company now that deals, and I believe you have a customs facility there. You actually can bring international trade into a duty-free zone or a customs secure area.
Yeah, we're for 22 years we've been a U.S. Customs Central Examination Station and a foreign trade zone operator.
So you are a foreign trade zone operator now?
We are.
How many other companies like yours in the Minnesota area have that kind of status or that kind of capability?
Well, there's three others besides ourselves in Minnesota. And we are, the one that's most close to our definition is Murphy Warehouses.
They do it also? And there's a couple others.
Right.
Do you get any kind of tax rebates or incentives or exemptions for doing that?
No.
Okay. That's all the questions I have at this time. Thanks. Okay. Mr. Corner? Welcome to the committee. And the usual, if you state your name for the paper.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Barry Kerner, and I'm a freight forwarder, local freight forwarder here in Minneapolis. I haven't done this kind of stuff.
We're going to look for the little handout that you gave us.
Okay.
So that we can follow along also.
I haven't done this since about the seventh grade, so believe me, it'll be very quick.
You'll do fine.
What I can do is speak from my experience as a freight forwarder for the last 28 years, and with the current volumes and such that I'm handling now.
Were there more of these provided to the committee? members or? Apparently there weren't more, so members can follow along with the slides and go from there.
Good chair.
Mr. Turner, go ahead. Sorry about that.
All right, no problem. Thank you. Again, I'll just speak from the current volumes and local, hopefully, expertise if I can help you out. Just a little bit of a profile. I'm the branch manager for Geologistics Americas in Minneapolis, which means my responsibility is over all aspects of transportation for the branch here. Geologistics itself is a $3 billion company with 450 offices in 100 countries. The local revenues that we're currently handling is about $9 million. I'd say that is average to a little above average for a freight forwarder in the Minneapolis area. Our largest export lane is Minneapolis to Bangkok, and we're shipping over 24 lower deck containers a week.
That would be belly freight, right?
Well, we'll start a little bit of the education process. A lower deck position is relatively about 122 inches by 88 inches wide. A lower deck is 62 inches max for a height. So if you can see one of Ron's tractor trailers going down the road, about four of those fit into one of his tractor trailers going down the road. Again, I'll speak from volumes again. A typical 747 freighter will hold 30 such positions. A typical 747 passenger will hold 9 of these positions. And the only reason I'm bringing this up again is that sometimes people question the amounts of freight that we possibly have. I can't speak from other freight forwarders, but for myself, there does seem to be, from that specific lane, the possibilities at least to look into this a little farther as far as the volumes. Again, we've heard the word integrated operators, and we'll talk again a little bit about them. I, as a freight forwarder, almost act as a broker. In other words, I'll hire somebody locally to pick up the freight from Fargo or Duluth or Edina, bring it back to my facility, and then I either ship it out of Minneapolis or we truck it down to Chicago, and then I hire an air carrier out of Chicago to fly the freight to the destination. I also have a gateway down there. Geologistics has a gateway down there, as does all the freight forwarders, the major freight forwarders. What the gateway does is it consolidates all the freight from the region, puts it across their dock, and I think as Dan was saying, it based on the consolidation factor, scales of economies, decisions are made then on what air carrier gets the freight at what particular rate people are willing to pay. The Bangkok lane that I have myself, I don't go over a gateway per se. I work directly with a carrier. With FedEx and UPS as the integrators that we've talked about, you know, the one thing we really must remember is they're kind of driven by the small package market. In other words, cargo is a great way to subsidize their revenues from the small package market. But the primary decisions aren't based on cargo in one specific, cargo per se, large pieces of freight, like I'm talking about in one area or another. It's primarily the small package market. And also, the primary stakeholders are in Louisville and Memphis for these two carriers. And that's something that I think is very important to remember. A typical global transaction for a medium forwarder such as myself is utilizing the Chicago Gateway. And this type of freight is very low in GP with a six-day transit cycle. And I know Ron has talked to this, that the 6 days is by choice. I'm sorry, gross profit. It's a very small margin for whoever more or less wants to fight over the business. And the transit time has really not improved in over 25 years. one of the reasons I think that Ron made the comment to that six-day cycle and not improving is that there is not enough disciplines by the forwarders themselves of either origin or destination to get the job done. One of the reasons that we're handling the lane ourselves here for the Bangkok is that we work very diligently with the origin, and we have very good relationships with the carriers, and then the disciplines at destination to push the freight through once it gets to the destination. I can give you an example here of a cycle time, if we can break it down into hours, though. The 6 days, if you look at a 6 day, that's 144 hours. I'll give you a recent scenario that was put onto my group by a customer that needed a 60-hour cycle time. We had to basically blend different modes of transportation to do this, but it could be done. The only way that I could possibly do this, however, was to basically hire an exclusive truck that left my dock and went right down to an airline in Chicago so we can make it for their lockout in the morning, because the typical trucks don't get down there in time. Then what we did is we contracted out to a carrier for a specific flight, and then we pushed the freight through for clearance, and then we had about a 2-hour delivery. So we were able to do that, but we don't have a normal mechanism to do that in the Minneapolis area right now. So there are ways to accommodate that freight without using a UPS or a FedEx. If you look at the cost, what we're talking about here also, and I'll be pretty candid with some of the costs here, we use three different carriers to get this freight to Bangkok. We use Eva Air and China Air out of Chicago, and we use Northwest out of Minneapolis. Again, the cost used Northwest to do an expedited type service is a little over $5 a kilo. The cost on China is a little under $1 a kilo. So you can see there's a significant cost variance if you're to use the different types of carriers. So with that said, again, it lends itself, there's a lot of wiggle room if you can see a difference of $4 a kilo that's created there. Last night, and this is one of the reasons I got little bags under my eyes, is my air export manager's on vacation. A typical night last night was we had 55 skids of freight that went down to Chicago. A skid of freight, again, is 48 inches by 40, and it goes about 5 feet tall. And we had 55 skids last night at about 13,000 kilos. So there is a significant amount of traffic that's there that the RDC possibly could see as freight. The GP on the freight that we have deferred, if you will, is a lot lower than the gross profit that we have for expedited freight. Getting into the security, I know we've touched on that a little bit. The primary policy right now is the known shippers program. Air freight forwarders such as myself have to qualify a shipper. In other words, we go out and we do a site visit to that shipper. Once we do qualify them, they're updated into the TSA website and they're a known shipper. With that said, everybody can probably see some of the downside when it comes to the current program as it stands now. That's going out to the farthest point, which is the shipper, and qualifying them. Once they're qualified, that's really the only inspection that you really have to do with this shipper. And then from then on, the shipper's known in the database for anybody to access if they have access to the TSA website. With the security on the horizon, in addition to the known shippers program, industry, myself, I guess included, is talking about self-accreditation, which I'm not 100% in favor of. It's basically the forwarders themselves determining what shipments may be worth an additional inspection. Again, there's a 2005 appropriations bill that I believe Senators Markey and Leahy were co-authoring. And the procedure to procure systems to inspect and screen cargo and passenger aircraft, enhance the known shippers program, triple percentage of cargo inspected on passenger aircraft. They're all very admirable, and of course we're all in favor of that. The downside is that if the Senators Markey and Leahy have their way, they would like the inspection of 100% of the cargo. If this becomes the case, it would be very detrimental to the industry here. Again, freight porters such as myself that would have to either utilize the services of FedEx or UPS now to get my freight to destination, or go through the 100% screening process, which would delay my freight, and I wouldn't have a way to get my freight from origin to destination in a 60-hour cycle time, per se.
We can wrap up here in the next couple minutes, and I'm going to get Mr. Zierton too. So,
Why I believe in the RDC. I believe that this is a tool in Minnesota's toolbox that can actually attract markets, not businesses. It's where the state would look at this as a way to attract perhaps a pharmaceutical market, not just a pharmaceutical company. The multi-modal facility that is flexible to adapt to industry changes, such as security. If we had one place to concentrate our efforts when it did come to security, where we had all the federal agencies, we'd be able to concentrate our resources at one facility to address these. And the concept allows economies of scale without giving up the competitive entrepreneurial nature of the freight forwarding business. Again, this gateway concept works. We're all doing it now. This would be a very wonderful facility that would be able to accommodate all the forwarders' concerns and needs, yet the gateway concept would be pulled back to Minneapolis instead of having it in Chicago right now. And I guess the most important thing is the control and ownership of our region's traffic. This region would be able to, on behalf of the shippers and the businesses in Minneapolis, basically dictate what the needs are, and we'd be able to accommodate our shippers better. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kerner, how do you the freight forwarder rate as far as making a comparison to other freight forwarders in the industry across the nation? Minneapolis, Chicago, Detroit, wherever. Where are you in the scheme of things as far as profits and losses and amount of goods that you move ton-wise versus, say, someone?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, geologistics itself is probably in the average. Minneapolis is an average size office for geologistics. Geologistics itself is probably in the top 7 globally as a freight forwarder. Is that addressing there? Okay.
Thank you.
Good, thank you. Appreciate your comments, and I'm sorry we're running a little tight on time here, but we want to get Mr. Jonathan, is it Zierd from Mankato? Are you here today? Gentlemen, sir, please go up and identify yourself. And Mr. Kerner, if you'd kind of stick around a little bit too, there may be further questions a little bit later here. Thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the panel. My name is Jonathan Zierk, and I represent the community of Mankato, Blueworth County, the Greater Mankato Economic Development Corporation, and their application as one of the communities that submitted in response to the RFP. My presence here really is less from the expertise side, and I, like you, am anxious to hear more and learn more about this particular industry and the assets this can be to our businesses as well as to our economy and the state. And really more I want to emphasize our community's readiness and excitement to be one of the applicants and be chosen as a location for this air cargo transit facility and the designation of the zone area. We think in particular that the Mankato marketplace, the location in Mankato, and in listening to some of the previous testifiers, does present some very interesting and advantageous positions. Some of the references to space and ability to construct a facility that can queue up the trucks appropriately and process them. In preparing our application, there's significant amounts of land that are available that would ideally present itself for that kind of a construction or build-out. In addition to that, the location of the facility is within the parameters of the distance, and it has immediate access to Trunk Highway 169, which recently was upgraded as an interregional corridor. So from a transportation standpoint, those assets are there. In addition to that, recently, as evidenced by Walmart's selection as Mankato as its first regional distribution center, serving in excess of a dozen states in food distribution, we think that that also speaks to the community's ability to work with logistics types of operations, speaks to its ability to entertain 24-hour operations, as well as the availability of a workforce and a semi-skilled workforce that can deal with those types of situations. They'll employ in excess, just the company alone, in excess of 500 employees, and we think that the surrounding community in the larger region has the ability to support that. So from an employment standpoint and support standpoint, we think there are recent developments in the greater Mankato marketplace that put it in good position to partner with the metropolitan community, the heavy concentration of manufacturers that exist in the metropolitan community, as well as if you triangle that out over the course of southern Minnesota, there's a heavy preponderance of manufacturers and producers of goods that exist from the metropolitan community to the south, central, and southeast part of the state, and Mankato is ideally situated for that. So just wanted to emphasize the application from our community. We'll be in attendance to learn more tomorrow as well, and we're excited to be an applicant, and we entertain any additional questions that you may have for us as a community, and be happy to bring our experts in as well.
Thank you, Mr. Zierich. Any questions or comments? Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question to him, but I have a question to you, Mr. Chair.
Well, before you question me, no, go ahead.
Is this committee involved in a site processing, or are we going to take a recommendation? No. We aren't involved in anything other than
we're just
the probability if there's funding involved.
Well, that'll be coming up to us in some changes to the program that Mr. Anderson spoke of. But I'm always glad to have the gentleman from Mankato here to tell us why they're a good city. And let me just commend you. I believe your airport commission has floated a bond issue and has had the foresight to expand to where you're going, 8,000 feet?
6,000 first.
6,000 first.
The discussion continues to build that out even further.
Well, that's a good discussion. I think you're headed in the right direction. So I tip my hat to you for seeing how important the airport is to your facility or to the growth of Mankato. Okay. So, Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank everyone who came today to give us the update on the very important challenges that we have in Minnesota for a regional distribution center, its viability. The questions remain open. The answers are not preordained, and I think that's a hallmark of moving forward on good public policy, and I appreciate the comments and the challenges of all the people that have testified here, and I hope that you will be agreeable at some further point of having another update hearing as the business plan moves forward, as we see more of the proposals from the communities that wanted the representative leader, although we're not an approval committee, and the transportation communities are not approval committee. Certainly, in the whole issue, all the issues of aviation, we have, in my opinion, been the legislature has been too far removed in just a general oversight position, and the more information we have, I think the better we are informed as these projects go forward across the state in terms of aviation improvements. Whether we say yay or nay, I think the issue is much broader than that, and I'm happy to chair our little subcommittee in the Senate and working with Representative Beard in the House.
Thank you. With that, Senator Rest does have a prior engagement. However, if you members would stay with me for just a few more moments, there are a couple questions I think that will help shed a little more light on the discussion as we move ahead. And Senator Rest, thank you for helping put this together today. I'd like to ask Mr. Anderson if he'd come back. I got a couple questions that might help as we consider these things. And thank you. And to all you testifiers, I really appreciate your insights, your perspectives, your people in the industry that actually make the world go round every day. And we appreciate your endeavors on behalf of citizens of Minnesota. Mr. Anderson, there's been discussion about this rural development regional development site, and as some of the people actually involved in the industry spoke, I was a little puzzled as to about whether or not if we do a site, a freight forwarder, an aggregator, or anybody like that, would they be required to move to that location or just route their freight through there on the way to and from the airport? Will they actually have to leave their facility in Mendota Heights or Eagan or Plymouth or wherever? You follow me?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yes. Our attitude about this was clearly not to force somebody to participate. And I think anyone in the freight forwarder community, for instance, could stay outside of that environment if they chose to do that. We hope that as we develop the business plan, most, if not all, would join in that regional distribution center concept. And then I think the other impetus, there are two other pieces to the impetus here. One is if the security things change, it would probably drive some forwarders into that environment. And then the other aspect of it is if, in fact, the shippers, particularly major shippers in Minnesota, are getting better access to global markets, they would probably be in the business of encouraging the forwarders to participate in a better environment. So I think the marketplace will work as the regional distribution center comes together.
And if I read the proposal correctly, this isn't just about aggregating, consolidating freight. There's actually, I think, the anticipation that manufacturers may actually locate there as well. Hopefully manufacturers that will be dealing with products that are sensitive to timely air movement.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly correct. And one of the reasons we structured the proposal at that size, at the Job Z thresholds, was to, in fact, attract people into that environment, some of which will probably be existing Minnesota businesses. The other side, Ron Half mentioned the other aspect of this, which is the import side, which we really don't spend a lot of time talking about, but I do want to say that the folks who are involved in the import business in Minnesota have been relatively strong supporters of this proposal, too, because they see some advantages. And as we work through the business plan, we're going to work on both ends of this, both the export and the import side of it.
Further questions for Mr. Anderson? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, in your looking at the Foreign Trade Zone Commission, I see by the statistics that were presented by Mr. Half that you know, our cargo has dropped considerably in at least the last year or two. It's come down from 315,000 tons to 299,000 tons. What's the expectation of the commission in looking at markets? Do we have the wherewithal to go out 400 miles as a radius or circumference, whatever, to find enough cargo to come in? And what is it to compete with the rest of the United States to be able to be...
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, when we've had this discussion, again, the business plan is going to direct us on some of that and look at that. But in the past, when we've talked to the Global Trade Association, which is a group of businesses that are Minnesota-based, Western Wisconsin-based, South Dakota, North Dakota, and probably further out, they saw some advantage to that watershed coming together potentially around the Minneapolis site. And as a practical matter, I think the cargo people could talk more succinctly about this, but there's cargo moving today from Oregon to Huntsville, Alabama, by truck. There's cargo moving from the Denver area into Chicago and elsewhere. There is a market, there's a watershed out there which, if things unfold in the proper environment, that we could attract some of that business in that watershed with the right facility and the right business plan.
Representative Pugh.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, Mr. Kerner mentioned something about the very low profits in this industry and the incentives to get people to come into that. Is that something that concerns you?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, I think everybody knows that the margins have shrunk in this business all across the board. One of the advantages potentially of the regional distribution center is to put some of those cost structures into a more scalable environment and take advantage of economies of scale. For instance, forwarders around the state right now have a lot of warehouse space that they currently have and probably use it 1 month or 2 months or 3 months a year, and the rest of the time that space goes wanting. Well, they're paying for that, and that's cutting into their margins. If we have a regional distribution center where we might have the opportunity for shared space, they don't have to carry that space for the full period of time for an annual basis. So there's some opportunities there. Having common dock space, common other handling equipment, and so on could, in fact, increase the margins of the forwarder industry and or reduce the cost to the shipping industry in Minnesota. So there's an opportunity, I think, to improve margins, again, if the regional distribution center is put together in the right environment.
Okay. Representative Leader?
I'm going to ask a really stupid question.
But I'd like to do that for a change.
Mr. Anderson, in the Grand Forks area, when they were talking about closing the Grand Forks Air Base, they were talking about a regional distribution center at the old air base. And I think the city of Grand Forks or Fargo, someone up there, is still talking about it. But with the foreign trade stuff that we have, is there a probability, or what's the situation in Canada, like at Winnipeg? Do they, there's a lot of traffic that comes down 94. Is some of that a probability of coming into this area when you say you're talking that distance, which you just spoke about?
Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Leader, Mr. Muscatello would probably be better to speak to that than I am, but I think, yes, there is an opportunity for that to come into this marketplace. And I know the North Dakota legislature, I think last year, approved some funding for a regional distribution center. And I think originally they were looking at that at for Bismarck. But I do know that the air base has come into play. I think, as Mr. Muscatello pointed out, the air base closure business and linking up cargo has not proven to be very successful across the country because the infrastructure is so huge and the opportunity in some of those watersheds relatively small.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Good, thank you. Well, barring any other questions, let me just kind of sum this up then. It appears that in the near future, the three requests for proposals are going to be considered. A site will be selected around which then a business plan will be contracted for. And we have to know the site before we can build the business plan. And once the business plan is done, it'll be after that time that a decision will be made whether to go ahead with this or not. Is that a correct assumption?
Mr. Chairman, that's a very good summary.
Okay. Well, thank you then, members, for coming today, and thank you to everyone who testified here today. I should point out we do have some members of the Pine County Commissioners are here today. I think they have an application into the process, as well as our friends from Mankato. Thanks for coming down, and I hope there is some light shed on the subject for you. And one other note, on February 15th, this Joint Aviation Subcommittee will hold a hearing here again to discuss land use issues and statewide zoning. We'd invite you all to come back for that. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned.